For the week of November 22nd, 2009, this is Showbiz Sandbox, Episode 30, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in Los Angeles, I'm Karen Woodward.
And on location with the wolf pack of Team Jacob, I'm Michael Giltz.
Wait, shut up, really?
No.
Oh.
Well, if you give us an hour this week, as always, you will be pleased because you will learn everything that's happening in the entertainment world. We have a ton of news to go over today, from the big box office and big video game returns to the Oscar shortlist for documentaries to Oprah Winfrey leaving television. We even have a little theater news for Michael, just to pepper it with a little musical news. And of course, we'll be doing Big Deal, Big Whoop. And we'll end today by talking about Disney's Rich Ross, who is shaking up Hollywood. But we're going to have to do it quickly because I have got to immediately start writing my female unrequited love vampire novel.
All right. But should we start with the box office while you're working on your headline and your lead to your novel?
Sure.
Okay. Well, the big news of the box office this week, obviously, is Sandra Bullock's The Blind Side, which opened at number 2 with $34 million. It was a huge hit. It performed much better than people expected. Coming on top of The Proposal, this makes Sandra Bullock the biggest female box office star in the world right now. It was a huge success. That came in at number 2 with $34 million. At number 1 was another film, The Twilight Saga: New Moon. It grossed about $100 million more than The Blind Side. It came in at $140 million. The record midnight screening, one of the biggest three-day openings of all time, $258 million worldwide. Teenage girls and their mothers had a great time. Number 3 was 2012, which had $26.5 million, a pretty substantial drop, but it opened big, and so it's still doing fine. It's over $100 million. An animated film, Planet 51, opened okay at $12.6 million, but I've seen the film and I bet it drops quick. At number 5 is A Christmas Carol, which is chugging along. It's now at $80 million total. Precious had another big week. It expanded to 629 screens. It made another $11 million. It's already at $21 million. That's a huge amount for this type of film. The Men Who Stare at Goats made another $2 million. Couples Retreat is above $100 million. The Fourth Kind, Law Abiding Citizen, and number 11 is Michael Jackson's This Is It, which made another $1.5 million and now has made $70 million at the U.S. box office. So, again, the big news was Sandra Bullock and, of course, Twilight Saga: New Moon. I saw it. Karen, did you? And if you didn't, I'm going to be awfully disappointed.
No, I'm going to see it on Friday. It's going to be my Thanksgiving movie.
How is it that I saw that movie and you didn't?
Because I'm scared of the tweeners on opening weekend. Sorry.
Oh, I went during the day, so I wouldn't have to deal with the tweeners.
I wish I had that luxury.
I waited till Sunday night, and it was a little calmer. It was still a full theater, but it wasn't. You didn't have to line up like Friday and Saturday night. When I went to see Planet 51 and almost went to see The Blind Side, there were just lines out the door. People were waiting and camped out just to get a seat for a random screening. It was a madhouse. What did you think, Sperling?
You know what? Here is a movie that, you know, probably isn't very good as far as cinema goes, as far as, you know, die-hard film fanatics would not necessarily like this movie. However, here is a moment where piracy actually worked, because I saw the first Twilight movie on a website, and I was doing a story on films that were not necessarily camcordered, but somehow wound up on the web, either through post-production facilities or through some nefarious means. And I started watching it thinking, okay, well, how much of the movie is really there? I wound up watching the entire film and kind of liked it. So now when the second movie comes out, I wind up going to the movie theater, paying $9.50 for a ticket, paying some ungodly amount for popcorn and soda. I think in the end, I wound up spending close to $24 at the movie theater to see Twilight Saga: New Moon. I never would have done that if I hadn't seen the first film on the internet for free. And I kind of liked Twilight Saga: New Moon. It's not a great film, but you know what? It's kind of a guilty pleasure.
Yeah, it's candy.
Yeah.
I wish it was more of a guilty pleasure. There's a hilarious moment where Taylor Lautner, our heroine, cuts her forehead and is bleeding, and he takes off his shirt to mop up the blood, and everybody in the audience sort of laughed when I saw it because it was such an Abercrombie and Fitch moment. It was so ridiculous. He just runs around the movie in jean shorts and no shirt for the entire film. But yeah, it would be nice if somebody could act well in this movie. I thought it was pretty bad. It was slightly better than the first one, but still pretty awful. It was a pretty dull, modest, guilty pleasure, you know.
No, but I mean, I guess it's really a great concept executed kind of in a mediocre way.
So is that a commentary on Chris White?
I think it's a commentary on the novel. I think it's a commentary on Chris White's. Chris White's is a very good filmmaker. He should really make movies where two people talk to one another in witty banter without the special effects, because About a Boy is great, American Pie works, but his special effects movies, The Golden Compass and now this one, aren't necessarily his best efforts.
Well, of course, we might talk about it later, but Chris White's was very, very unhappy about The Golden Compass. He said they cut about half an hour of the film. They screwed it up. They were afraid of the book. It was the worst experience he had in his career. So he really feels a weight off his shoulders having done this franchise, this type of movie, and doing it the way he wants. I'll agree. About a Boy is good. American Pie is okay, but he's launched a franchise, I guess. So good for him.
I was really surprised that Warner Brothers decided to open The Blind Side against Twilight Saga New Moon. That's not necessarily counter-programming.
Because a lot of moms went to Twilight Saga.
Right, exactly. A lot of the mothers with their daughters went to see Twilight Saga New Moon and thus weren't seeing The Blind Side. However, it dawned on me, and somebody suggested, that The Blind Side was the movie that parents went to see when they dropped their kids off to go see Twilight New Moon.
Ah, that makes
sense. Interesting. That's interesting.
Well, and it worked. It opened very strongly, $34 million for that movie.
$34 million for that movie on a week where the Twilight Saga New Moon opened. That's pretty darn good, if you ask me.
Yeah.
Well, now, Michael Jackson's This Is It, you mentioned that it's $70 million and that it dropped off 69%. However, it did also drop 1,397 screens.
Well, that's what happens at the tail end of you make it sound like the box office dropped because it lost screens, but no, it lost screens because it's running out of steam and it's at the end of its run.
True.
Sorry.
That's true. Well, no, that's true.
But, you know, Sperling, I don't think you've made an argument for pirating. You made an argument for DVDs, and you could have gone to Redbox and rented Twilight Saga for a dollar. You could have streamed it online. You could have gotten it via Netflix. You could have rented the DVD. You could have watched somebody else's DVD. There was no need to steal it.
Well, yeah, wait, hang on for a second while I go call the FBI.
Yeah. No, you did a first story. I understand that. But I'm saying in general, there's no need to steal it. It's available plentifully and easily. So why should you have to steal it?
What I'm saying is I never in a million years intended to watch that movie at all. I intended on missing every single one of these films. Every single one. I'm not saying piracy is good, and I'm not saying that people should do this. What I'm saying is sometimes when you give something away for free, you actually attract more people to your business. And that's exactly what happened.
That's the first law of social media marketing.
That's
right. But it's a dollar. It's a dollar to rent it. How much cheaper do you have to be than that? A dollar a day.
Yeah, but here's the thing.
But you have to go and get it.
And I had no intention of doing either of those things, going to get it or paying the dollar to see Twilight at all.
I guess you're making an argument for having to do a story about piracy.
Well, yeah.
If everybody would do that, we'd be all right.
Well, and you're doing an argument for maybe streaming. Netflix allowing people to pay
it's
to stream.
So easy there, yeah.
You know what really annoyed me, though, when I went to see the Twilight New Moon movie, was there were 8 trailers before that film. Presumably because everybody knew it was going to be the big film for the weekend, and all of the distributors wanted their trailers in front of Twilight, and all of the exhibitors kind of had to capitulate to some degree. But there were 8 trailers, most of which were for chick flicks, and 2 of which were for Nicholas Sparks adaptations. I couldn't believe it.
Sweet!
Two. There must have been a story and then a trailer later, like one of those advanced TV show stories where they pretend to have a show and they talk about upcoming movies.
No. This was literally 8 trailers back-to-back, strung together.
And 2 of them were for Nicholas Sparks.
Well, Nicholas Sparks adaptations, yes.
Oh, different movies.
Yes.
I beg your pardon. Oh, okay, I understand it. Well, Twilight Saga made a lot of money. It made $258 million worldwide, which is huge. But to put it in perspective, a video game came out, and in its first week, Call of Duty Modern Warfare 2 grossed about $550 million. I don't even know if that includes overseas, but we're going to talk to Ben Fritz about that from the LA Times. You know more about him, Sperling.
Well, yes, and while I dial him up here, I know that Karen, you have a conference call due to some scheduling fiasco this week.
She has an actual job.
Yeah, go figure. So, Karen, I'm going to dial up Ben, and will you join us afterwards?
Yeah.
Okay, joining us now on Skype is Ben Fritz, an entertainment business reporter for the Los Angeles Times, where he contributes to the popular Company Town column and blog. Before that, Ben was the video games critic and editor at the Hollywood trade paper Variety, where he also wrote the popular video game blog The Cutscene. He is also the co-author of a book titled All the President's Spin, George W. Bush, The Media, and The Truth. He's been the managing editor of Digital Coast Reporter and freelanced for outlets such as Salon, Slate, and the Philadelphia Inquirer, just to name a few. You can follow Ben on Twitter, and I highly suggest you do. A lot of your tweets are very funny. The username to look up is @BenFritz. Welcome, Ben.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Now, Ben, the reason we wanted to have you on is you wrote an interesting story on Call of Duty Modern Warfare 2, which I guess is kind of in your wheelhouse since you were the video games editor over at Variety, and you write about video games at the Los Angeles Times. In fact, mm-hmm. you write about so much at the Los Angeles Times. When do you sleep?
I figure that's the way you stay employed as a journalist in the year 2009, is you just keep running so much that they just... That they won't be able to, you know, to find a free time to notice you when they're cutting costs. So yeah,
they'd be afraid to fire you.
Yes, exactly. That's my goal, to just.
Well, Ben, you did stories also on New Moon, and I wanted you to compare Call of Duty Modern Warfare 2 and its debut week to New Moon, because everybody went crazy over the Twilight Saga New Moon, which made $258 million worldwide. How does that compare to what Call of Duty did its first week?
Well, Call of Duty in its first 5 days did $550 million in gross sales.
Is that the U.S. or the world?
That's worldwide. So on Fanta's face, it's about approximately twice as much worldwide as New Moon. But they're very difficult to compare. Video games, you know, a video game costs $60. A movie ticket on average is like $7.75. You know, movies make more revenue from DVDs and cable, and video games make virtually all their revenue from retail. So... They're difficult to compare, but certainly on you could one thing you can say just flat out is people spent more money on Call of Duty Modern Warfare 2 the first week it came out than they spent seeing New Moon its first weekend.
Indeed, and actually you have a quote from Activision Blizzard chief executive Bobby Kotick, who mm-hmm. says, "My goal was to create a launch that would compare very favorably to the biggest box offices of all time," and indeed it was the biggest gross for any entertainment property in a 5 day period.
Yes, that was a big publicity goal, and also, you know, they really wanted to prove that they could do it with the game and with their product. And you know, we're in a society where we pay so much attention to box office that I think everything else is measured against it, you know, for better or for worse. And so that was their benchmark, and they blew it away.
And they
now the reviews for New Moon were weak. What were the reviews like for Call of Duty? What did you think of it, and what's been the critical reaction?
Yes, the critical reaction has been excellent. I mean, the developer Infinity Ward, you know, is very, very well regarded in the industry, and so perhaps, you know, and the video game critics went crazy for it. So it was certainly got much better reviews than New Moon did.
Well, and of course, it's the fourth part of a franchise, if I'm not mistaken.
It's actually the sixth part of the call. It's the sixth Call of Duty game.
Now, how do you find time not only to write as much as you do? I think you had at least two stories in the Los Angeles Times this past week on New Moon, just Thursday and Friday. And then, of course, you wrote the story Frustration over Oscar's documentary shortlist, which we'll be talking about later.
Okay.
But how do you find time to play video games?
Well, I don't play them as much as I used to when I was at Variety, I'll admit. But yeah, I mean, video games are usually my relaxing time, kind of after my wife goes to bed. So usually at, you know, kind of 10:30 or 11, I'll play a game for an hour or two before I go to bed some nights. That's usually my video game kind of wind down time.
Now, for somebody, you play video games and you have a wife, you really are successful.
Yes.
Before you came on, I was telling in our prep meeting, I was telling Michael that basically Ben Fritz is living the life I always wanted to live. He's working for the big town paper that's at the end of my driveway every morning, and he's playing video games. And every time I read some of your Twitter posts, you're at one party or another. I don't know how you find time to do it all.
I don't know. Yeah, it's tiring, but you know, I do feel very, very lucky. I have a job that I love. I follow an industry I find interesting. I get to play video games and call it work. So yes, I do feel very blessed.
Do you find it frustrating that more attention, I mean, it's getting better. The New York Times now has sort of a regular video game reviewer. Do you find it frustrating that more attention isn't paid to video games? Because they really are a huge, you know, cultural force, and they have been for, you know, 20 years now, and they just keep growing and getting bigger.
Yes, I definitely think, you know, that the amount of cultural respect, especially the video game industry gets, is lagging behind its influence. And that's something I'm doing my best to change. And, you know, it is great that New York Times has someone who writes about them, is a reviewer and culturally full-time. And I've been doing a few pieces for our art section that we call Calendar about different games, mm-hmm. and I've got more in the works. So, but yes, I do agree. I think people are covering it more as a business like they should, but definitely the kind of cultural arts coverage is lagging compared to other media.
And there was another video game launched recently, and, you know, when a big title comes out, it can crush the competition or it can raise all the ships. You know, the excitement can bring everybody together. How did Assassin's Creed 2 do, you know, critically and commercially?
The reviews seem to be very good. Not as good as they are for Modern Warfare 2, but better than for the first Assassin's Creed. It's a beautiful, gorgeous game. I haven't played it yet. I've only seen clips. And people are a little bit mixed on the gameplay, but seem to mostly like it. There isn't yet any sales data. I mean, I think it just launched last week. So the sales data hasn't come out yet. But I honestly can't say anything about how it's selling. I honestly don't know yet.
Well, apparently video game sales are down 12% year over year through October. And mm-hmm. it seems that didn't affect Modern Warfare at all.
Modern Warfare, yeah, was the exception to the rule for sure. And, it goes to show that every once in a while when there's a real blockbuster, It can break through the clutter. And this, if anything, it's like some video game fans were saving their money. This was the one they wanted to buy this year. People who maybe had less money to spend on other games. But yeah, it has been a tough year for new game sales.
What other video games are coming out this year, possibly for the holidays, that mm-hmm. you're looking forward to and that video game players are looking forward to?
Most of the big games have come out or are just about to come out. I just started playing and personally love this game called Left 4 Dead 2. Mm-hmm. Follow-up, obviously, to Left 4 Dead 1 that came out last year. It's a great multiplayer game it's essentially like a zombie movie, and four survivors, four people play together as survivors in New Orleans fighting their way through the zombie apocalypse. And it's just brilliantly made and very, very kind of tongue-in-cheek. And it's a great game to play with friends, and it's always different every time you play because the zombies always act differently. So I personally love that. Assassin's Creed 2, as you mentioned it, I think is a very highly anticipated game. There was a new Super Mario Brothers game for the Wii that came out last week that a lot of Nintendo fans were looking forward to. Then there's a game called Saboteur that comes out in a few weeks from EA. It's kind of an open world spy game set in France during the Nazi occupation. And it very interesting art style. The game is all black and white, but as you kind of help drive out the Nazis and liberate France, things turn to color. So you can see how successful you are based on how black and white versus color the game game world is, which is very cool.
Now you mentioned playing with friends, mm-hmm. and I know a lot, you know, with Xbox Live, and I believe the PlayStation has a similar service, a lot of people are sitting at home playing a video game against someone else that isn't there. And mm-hmm. if I'm not mistaken, you used to be a part of a kind of a Hollywood club that would get together and play video games. Am I completely...
No, you're right. I still am part of the club. They call it Nerd Poker. The idea being it's kind of like poker used to be the big social networking event, but since we're all nerds, we do it by playing video games. And so, yeah, sometimes if you were to find me in my living room at 11 p.m. or midnight, you see me talking seemingly to myself, but actually I have the headset on and I'm playing with some of my friends, and most of them are professionals in the entertainment industry doing one thing or another. And we're playing games and talking to each other.
Do you ever get together all in one place?
Yes,
to do this.
We do. I mean, a lot of them are my good friends. And like we had a party at my house on Saturday because we had a friend in town, and my wife did, and several of the people I invited are people I know from Nerd Poker. And then also we have our own kind of, we have one or two big Nerd Poker parties per year. We just had one last month. It was just a week before Halloween, and it was a costume party. Everybody was dressed up as video game characters.
Now, well, I cover DVDs, and I find it very frustrating because the studios basically don't want to release any information about how titles are selling and how many units they're selling. They keep it a big secret unless they absolutely have something huge to trump it.
Yep.
Is there any sort of regular reporting of sales the way we get for movie grosses and TV ratings and album sales? Or do you have to depend on the studios to release that information for video game sales as well?
Yeah, so there is some regular reporting. There's an analysis company called NPD, and every month they put out a list of the top 10 selling games and overall industry stats. And then sometimes you can get information on more specific titles if you ask them or if you have a good source who has their data. But it's hit and miss. It's not just released to everybody. So it's definitely not easy. There's some games where if I want to find out sales data, I have to push and get sources to tell me stuff off, you know, secretly. And there's sometimes I just can't get it. So it's, I'd say it's a little bit easier than DVDs, but definitely tougher than box office.
Well, now, Modern Warfare 2 sold 8 million copies, mm-hmm. and Activision is suggesting that they will probably sell about 15 million copies. So they've basically sold half of their, basically half the run at this point.
Yes.
They've, is that common?
That is common. For a very popular video game, often they do most of its sales up front. The video games, sales tend to be very front-loaded. People, if it's something that appeals to the fans, hardcore fans, they turn out to buy it right away. A lot of people pre-order it so they can get it the day it comes out because they want to start playing right away. So that's it's not surprising, and it's again a difference from movies. You know, a lot of times movies come out and then it keeps playing for a month or two, and then some people still wait to see it on DVD or on TV. But at video games, again, it's very front-loaded.
Right, and of course, while they may sell 15 million units directly at $60, mm-hmm. the secondary market will sell another. Yep. Load of them.
Absolutely. So that's only the copies that Activision sells. And yeah, there'll undoubtedly be millions more where people sell a used copy. And that's a big issue in the game industry because Activision doesn't get any of that money and they obviously hate that.
Right. Well, now I know you write a lot about video games. You write a ton about movies.
Mm-hmm.
Over the weekend, I read at least two or three posts on the Company Town blog and on the LA Times website. And I believe it was John Horn, who said, or maybe it was Jeff Boucher when we were speaking with either one of them, that said the LA Times website is one of the fastest growing blog networks on the internet today.
Yes.
Do you find it difficult to try and keep up with feeding that beast?
It is. That's a great question. It is difficult. And because we want, you know, yeah, we do a lot of our traffic through our blogs, and we make a concerted effort to do most of our breaking news on the blogs and then also do some analysis. And so, you know, keeping Company Town fresh, you know, we try to do, you know, several posts per day at least. And, you know, some days there's so much news that you sort of find that between the six of us, we've written six or eight posts without even trying. But some days, you know, the news, it's a slow news day and we have to sort of think of new angles. But we do have a great guy who was hired along with me. His name is Joe Flint. And he's the lead. He's sort of the lead Company Town blogger. It's his primary responsibility to keep the blog going. So he's always either writing stuff himself or coming to us and suggesting ideas so that we can keep Company Town fresh and keep up the traffic. And it really has, since Joe and I joined in the spring, Company Town traffic has exploded. I think it's, you know, I think it's probably three times as big as it was, you know, when I started.
Well, as I've mentioned on previous episodes, in my opinion, you guys are doing a better job of covering the business of entertainment than some of the trade publications these days.
Well, thank you. That's definitely our goal.
Do your bosses see it as like a primary part of your job, or do they still sort of get it in the idea, in their head that, you know, you got to write your articles, and if you did that blog on the side, well, that's okay, but don't let it distract from the work.
Yeah, no. They definitely view it as a primary responsibility, and I think from what I hear from before I joined, it's been a big change to the paper in the past few years. I think what you said about, oh, do the web on the side may have been the attitude in the past, but now, you know, this is, I think the LA Times, we definitely consider ourselves a multimedia news operation. And while print is still perhaps the one that's most visible and the one that, you know, is still perhaps the one where we make the majority of our money, you know, web is a very big part of it. And I am definitely judged by my bosses on my productivity online as well as in print.
Well, a lot of the stuff you write appears online before it appears in the paper, because I'll pick up the paper in the morning at the end of my driveway and I'll be reading something and think, wait a second, I read this. I read this yesterday.
Yep, we definitely. If it's breaking news, then often, yeah, we're not going to wait till tomorrow morning to break the news. We want to break it first, and we do it on the web, and we want to keep up web traffic going all day, so people think, oh, you know, so people come to see that LATimes.com is a place where you need to go several times a day. That's our goal. So absolutely, if the things we don't put on the web early would be features, things that we know nobody else is going to have, and that maybe perhaps read better in print, frankly, than online. But if it's breaking news, if it's a short, punchy piece, we're going to do it on the web first. That's our charge. That's what we're told to do by our bosses.
And has writing for both outlets or writing for both mediums changed the way you write?
I do write differently. I wouldn't say it's changed just because I've been used to that my entire career. You know, I'm not under 30 anymore, but I'm still relatively young. And my career as a journalist has always been an internet. And I've always written for both. And, you know, I've done a lot of blog and internet stuff on the side on my own, even before I worked at Variety or when I was unemployed and, you know, in between stints and so on, freelancing. So I've always been used to doing both, but it definitely is a very different style. And I find since I kind of grew up on the web, so to speak, I find the tougher challenge for me is writing, you know, the kind of very, the kind of prose for print, so to speak, where I think the your writing style is, can sometimes be more important than on the web. So that's always a bigger challenge for me when I'm, if I'm doing a long feature for print, I have to really focus on my writing much more than I'm used to doing on the web.
It helps if you don't keep playing the video game while you try to write your article.
Yeah, that's probably what I'm doing wrong. I should leave my DS at home. I shouldn't be bringing it with me to the office.
Well, some of these video games are not short. I mean, they're 40, 50 hours long.
Yeah, that's right. And that's why you need to, I definitely don't play most games that come out. You know, I have to pick the ones I really want to play because, yeah, otherwise I would fall hopelessly behind or I would have to get divorced, one or the other. so I've chosen to fall behind. And yeah, because as a journalist, because I cover the industry, I get sent a lot of games and I give away, you know, 80% of them because I'm like, I'm never going to get around to playing this. So it's stupid to just let them pile up in my house.
I've got a PS3.
No, oh, yeah.
Well, Ben, thank you very much for joining us. We don't want to take up too much of your time, given that you have lots of video games to play in.
Yes, indeed. And I should do some work, too.
Yes.
But
well,
it's been my pleasure.
Well, is there anything else? Certainly, we've mentioned you're on Twitter. You're also mm-hmm. on Facebook. Yeah. Anything else that we should be mentioning and directing people towards?
No, just the two things I'd ask is direct them to my Twitter feed and direct them to the Company Town blog, which is latimes.com/companytown.
Okay, well, perfect. Thank you very much for taking the time to speak with us about Call of Duty Modern Warfare 2 and your piece about the astronomical opening, $550 million in sales that this video game made over the past week.
Sure thing. It was my pleasure.
Thank you.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye. Well, that was very nice of Ben Fritz from the Los Angeles Times to join us. We have to thank him for that. You know, I just realized as I was hanging up with him that I forgot to ask him about that controversial cutscene in Modern Warfare 2 where I guess a whole bunch of Russian... hold on a second while I dial Karen up. And Karen, you there?
I'm right here.
Okay.
I know. I just heard what you said. They didn't cut that. That's in it.
No, cutscene is I don't know. Cutscene is basically action that you don't direct yourself. So it's kind of like a little movie inside the video game.
Oh, but you're part of it. I'm really bummed that I didn't get a chance to be on with him because I did my homework for this one and I played Modern Warfare 2. And it's really fun. And I was in that level or whatever that's called. No, you're there. You are killing people. And I'm sort of anti-video games. I just don't get it. People who play it sort of annoy me. But I get it. I totally get it. It's violent. It's deadly. It's awesome. And you know who plays the voice for Soap, one of the main guys?
Uh-huh.
Kevin McKidd, Grey's Anatomy.
Oh, of course, very fun.
I've got a major crush on. So if you're into killing things, I highly recommend it.
Speaking of killing things, Oprah has killed her daytime franchise by saying she will walk away. It's 2 years down the road, practically, so we can hold back the tears. But Oprah will be walking away from her daytime platform that she will have had for 25 years. And it's a nice time to end, but it's certainly having huge repercussions throughout the industry. Sperling, you linked to a Wall Street Journal article, I think, talking about it, or an LA Times article.
No, it was a Wall Street Journal article.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
They argue that she can, that, you know, a cable channel will be ultimately more valuable to Oprah than the platform that she has right now.
Well, right. And part of why she might be leaving is her relationship with Roger King of King World, which was her syndicator, the person who brought her from Minneapolis to Chicago and made her a national name. And she was with them for, I guess, 22, 23 years. And Roger King passed away in December of 2007 during an acquisition by CBS of King World. And I guess since then, her heart really hasn't been in it. And she referred to her time on the show as a yellow brick road of blessings. Did either of you actually watch the her speech?
Not the announcement, because I'd already heard of it. What about you, Karen?
Did I watch the announcement? Did she have an official announcement?
Yeah, on air, she let viewers know that 2 years from now she would be
stepping down. I don't watch her show.
Do you want to hear her her statement? I have it queued up here. Let's see if I can.
After much prayer and months of careful thought, I've decided that next season, season 25, will be the last season of the Oprah Winfrey Show. And over the next couple of days, you may hear a lot of speculation in the press about why I am making this decision now. And that will mostly be conjecture. So I wanted you to hear this directly from me. 24 years ago, on September 8th, 1986, I went live from Chicago to launch the first national Oprah Winfrey Show. I was beyond excited, and as you all might expect, a little nervous. I knew then what a miraculous opportunity I had been given, but I certainly never could have imagined the yellow brick road of blessings that have led me to this moment with you. These years with you.
She's starting to cry.
Our viewers have enriched my life beyond all measure. And you all have graciously invited me into your living rooms, into your kitchens, and into your lives. And for some of you, longtime Oprah viewers, you have literally grown up with me. We've grown together. You had your families and you raised your children, and you left a spot for me in your morning or your afternoon, depending on when the Oprah Show airs in your town. So here we are, halfway through the season 24, and it still means as much to me to spend an hour every day with you as it did back in 1986. So why walk away and make next season the last? Here is the real reason. I love this show. This show has been my life. And I love it enough to know when it's time to say goodbye. 25 years feels right in my bones and it feels right in my spirit. It's the perfect number, the exact right time. So I hope that you will take this 18-month ride with me right through to the final show.
Okay, so essentially God told her that it was time for her show to end.
I hate it when people say they pray over, like, as if God cares when you end your massively financially successful syndicated television show. It's just that's just, but that's a different approach to faith. But it's one that I'm not down with.
Maybe it was the Wizard of Oz, considering she's been on this yellow brick road of opportunity or whatever.
And blessings.
Right. Which actually, a parenthetical aside here, I actually did see a movie this weekend that was Religulous.
Oh, what'd you think of it?
I highly recommend it.
It was fun.
That was the highest grossing documentary of 2008. But before we get into documentaries, because I know that's going to be our next subject, I thought it was very interesting how in the middle of her little speech there, which, by the way, I should point out I edited for the sake of time,
I couldn't tell.
Exactly.
Oh, my God. I know, right?
I think it ran about 3 minutes, 35 seconds, and I edited it down just for time. In the middle of it, she kind of gives a plug. Whenever the Oprah Show airs in your market, right in the middle of her tears, she's giving a plug to her show.
Yeah.
But you pointed out, Michael, that Joe Flint of the Los Angeles Times had either a blog post or a column called The Oprah Effect, Winners and Losers. And he's saying that the big winners are going to be Discovery Communications, which, of course, Oprah Winfrey is partnered up with for her network OWN, or the Oprah Winfrey Network. Mm-hmm. And that is due to launch in early 2011. Of course, Ellen DeGeneres has another daytime talk show for Warner Brothers, so she's going to get a boost in the ratings because there will be no female talk show host out there other than her for right now.
Oh. Well, no, there's plenty, but she might move up to her slots in the afternoon, which are more profitable. So she might move from that late morning slot to that 4 o'clock slot, depending on what market you're in. But she might take over that Oprah slot in a way for a lot of stations. But there are other female talk show hosts, Rachel Ray and Martha Stewart.
Sarah Palin.
Sarah Palin is not a talk show host. She's barely an author. Losers, according to Joe Flint, are CBS, which will no longer be able to count on the hundreds of millions of dollars that The Oprah Winfrey Show delivered in licensing fees each year, and of course the advertising revenue over all those years. ABC is probably also not too happy since the affiliates throughout the country carry her show. Most of them are ABC affiliates, and they use Oprah to go into their early evening local news, and they're going to obviously, at least for now, they're going to lose some ratings. And according to Joe Flint, Sony is also grumbling because it was trying to woo distribution rights to Winfrey's daytime show away from CBS when her deal expired. And they kind of point out that Winfrey herself may be a loser because odds are that at least in the short term, she's kind of going to disappear for a while. But in the long run, as you said, there will be, she has a better opportunity to make more money and a bigger impact by running and owning an entire cable network.
And one final loser may be people who have movies to promote, like Chris Rock's A Good Hair. I saw him on Oprah promoting his documentary film, Good Hair, and he was very funny on this show, and they showed a picture of Oprah as a little girl with her hair, and he said something like, oh, you're looking slave, because she had sort of nappy hair as a kid. But, you know, that platform for all those movies, smaller films that she promotes and pushes, like Precious and Good Hair. Good Hair is, you know, a documentary film that's out right now and it's doing well, though, as we've heard this week, it is not on the shortlist for the Oscar documentary nomination.
Yeah, there was a lot of controversy over this shortlist because a lot of the documentaries that were popular or were released and actually made money aren't on the list. So Michael Moore's Capitalism, A Love Story wasn't on the shortlist, and I guess nobody was crying over that. But then there were some really big surprises, like We Live in Public, which is the Andy Timoner film about Josh Harris.
Mm-hmm.
R.J. Cutler's September issue about the September issue of Vogue, which is a fantastic film and well worth seeing. Anvil, the story of Anvil, the rock band, wasn't on the list. And that people have been talking about for 2 years, and it didn't get it didn't make the short list. It might get Loud, also the documentary about the guitarists with
that was really good.
Yeah, Jimmy Page and The Edge and Jack White did not get nominated. The way the documentary selection process works is there's about 150 people who are documentary filmmakers who are a part of a committee, and they go through, I don't know how many documentaries, I guess it was like 87 this year, and they whittle it down to 19. And that's called the documentary shortlist. And this year, the list includes The Beaches of Agnes. I don't know what that movie
is. That's by Agnes Varda. It's okay. Critically acclaimed.
Burma Vijay and The Cove, two films that were at Sundance last year. Every Little Step, Facing Ali, Food Inc., a movie about where our food comes from. Garbage Dreams. Garbage Dreams, Living in Emergency, Soundtrack for a Revolution, Under Our Skin, Valentino, The Last Emperor, and Which Way Home. A lot of these films really had no box office. They just opened for the prerequisite week to qualify for the Oscars, and that was about it.
Well, that's a scheduling thing. You skipped over The Most Dangerous Man in America, Daniel Ellsberg and the Pentagon Papers, another good film. Food Inc. was highly acclaimed. The Cove was highly acclaimed. The Agnes Varda film, the Daniel Ellsberg film. This is the oldest story in the book. Basically, the documentary films are picked by old retired people who have the time to sit down and watch a bunch of documentary films and foreign movies. Those are the people who serve on the panels, fuddy-duddy old people who are retired. And they've been trying for 20, 30 years to try and come up with a way to whittle down the hundreds of movies eligible for foreign film and documentary film and make them more representative of the best and most acclaimed. But it's always, if a movie is the top grossing documentary film of the year, it almost never gets on the list, much less gets nominated and wins. It just happens all the time. This is such an old story.
What I'm wondering is the irony that in a year where they decided to open up the rules to have 10 Best Picture nominees, arguably to bring in more sexy movies and more sexy stars, that they're having this kind of problem with the documentaries.
Well, they always have problems with documentaries, and they always have problems with the foreign films too. So I don't necessarily know that it has anything to do with the fact that there are 10 films that can be nominated for Best Picture, although Michael Sipley did point out that films that were overlooked in the documentary shortlist this year can be nominated for Best Picture in that group of 10.
Right, but there's 19 films on this shortlist, so we're talking about a list that's even broader than the 10 movies nominated for Best Picture. So you're right, because there's such an explosion of documentaries in the last 10 years, and there's so many more are actually commercially released and actually make a couple million bucks that you could argue they have as much argument for expanding from 5 to 10 as the best picture. And animated films, I think, will be going from 3 to 5. You know, so there's foreign films. Are there only 5 good foreign films around the world? Why not 10? You know, spread the love. But you make a good point. And but I guess there's just more movies of all types being released nowadays.
Well, with all these new movies being released, they will at least have fodder for Broadway, because it seems that the only Broadway musicals being made are based on movies. I read something. Roger Friedman, Showbiz 411, over on The Hollywood Reporter. Soap Dish, next movie headed to Broadway with music. The 1991 satire of soap operas, starring Sally Field and Kevin Kline and Carrie Fisher and Robert Downey Jr., Gary Marshall and Terry Hatcher. I remember Elizabeth Shue being in that as well. They're turning it into a musical written by the British writers George Stiles and Anthony Drew, who were the folks that gave us the Mary Poppins musical, which is touring right now. The movie, by the way, was written by Robert Harling, of Steel Magnolias fame, and directed by Michael Hoffman, whose new film, The Last Station, will open later this year and is being favored heavily for a couple of awards, especially for Helen Mirren.
Well, it's a pretty good film. I like the Mary Poppins adaptation. I believe those two guys did the book for the Mary Poppins musical, and it's a strong book, so you know, they might do a good job. It's interesting, though. Daytime soaps are almost gone off the face of the earth. Mr. Mark Berman of Media Week had an article about the ratings for daytime TV, and it's down to just like 1 million, 2 million total viewers. It's very, very small, but it could be a pretty good Broadway show. But if I was going to turn a movie about soap operas into a Broadway musical, I would have done Tootsie.
Oh, that's like
Twilight.
Twilight the musical.
They're working on Twilight already, probably. But Tootsie is a much stronger film. It's got a really strong story. It's great. It's got big moments. Soap Dish is very funny, but it's sort of a satire, and it's sort of, that's a little trickier play. But I would have, Tootsie has a much stronger storyline and character and a romance. You know, there's a lot more heart in Tootsie than there is in Soap Dish. Soap Dish, I don't hear it singing to me when I think of that movie. But Tootsie, you can literally think of Tootsie, and you can think of the songs, right?
It's almost meant to be a musical.
Yeah. You know, it could work. Anything can work. Shrek the Musical didn't work, though. There's some articles this week about Shrek and how it was a collapse on Broadway, but it might make it back, not on the road, where it will go and hopefully make money. It'll make some money back there. Not on the road, not on Broadway, not in London, but at your local high school, because musicals have a huge afterlife at local high schools and local community theater productions. Shows that didn't do great on Broadway, like Footloose and All Shook Up, the Elvis Presley musical, they make a ton of money from people in high schools putting them on, put on a show.
Yeah,
and so Shrek could turn out to be a really big draw for high schools.
Yeah, I agree with you, Karen. Look at the costume budget for Shrek. I mean, you need a lot of costumes.
Never, ever going to happen.
No, well, you know, actually, that they had the same problem with A Little Shop of Horrors, that it wasn't working in high schools because they couldn't do it. And then what the people did was they built 15 of the Audrey, the talking plant, and they built 15 of them and shipped them around the country and rotated them around and let people use it. You know, they let them rent it out, and it's turned it into a massively successful property.
I mean, either that, or you don't need the costumes. You can just get the ugliest guy in school to play Shrek.
The ugliest guy? That's not bad.
Oh, I wish I was still in high school. I could have a starring role, finally. I lost out on Grease. I lost out on Bye Bye Birdie. I could have done Shrek. It's not easy being green.
I like Roger Friedman's casting suggestions for Soap Dish. He says, why not hire some of the real soap stars who are in and out of work these days? As the networks botch soaps completely, there are plenty of talented people out there up for consideration.
That's great, but you know who I'd love to see? He was in the film, Robert Downey Jr. So is it a big deal that they're turning Soap Dish into a Broadway musical?
Okay, is this your way of segueing into Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we determine whether the entertainment news of the week is a big deal or a big whoop? We have to get...
Call up your buddies at MGMT.
yeah, right. okay, Michael, do you want to take this first story? You highlighted this AOL Time Warner divorce thing, which I think it's a big deal.
I did.
Oh, I mean, it's kind of old news. It's a big deal, but at this point, it's a big whoop.
It wasn't when I put it on the show notes.
They've been talking about this for years.
They have, but and that's why I moved it down to big whoop, big deal, big whoop, because clearly you just answered it. It's big whoop. But the reason why I'm obsessed with it is because I worked at New Line when AOL Time Warner married each other, and I remember what a huge deal it was for obvious reasons. So now I'm equally obsessed with the divorce and just the major failure of a media company and an online company getting into bed together, so to speak. I find that really fascinating.
I say big whoop, divorce already.
To me, I this is old news, so it's a big whoop. Our second story is a report on the fact that movie theater popcorn makes you fat. Now, this is a story I wrote for Celluloid Junkie.
What?
Yes.
I know. That explains so much.
Well, it's a new study performed by the nonprofit group, the Center for Science in the Public Interest. And it reported that food items found at most movie theater concession stands are incredibly unhealthy. Lab tests revealed that eating a medium popcorn and soda combo from Regal Cinemas was the equivalent of eating 3 McDonald's Quarter Pounders topped with 12 pats of butter. And for those of you who are not calorie inclined, yeah, that's 1,610 calories or 60 grams of saturated fat. And then they went on to talk about the candy. A large box of Junior Mints was 570 calories and 8 grams of fat. Raisinets are 420 calories and 11 grams of fat. M&Ms, they may be tiny, but they pack in 790 calories and more than half a day's supply of saturated fat at 16 grams. And the whopper of them all was Reese's Pieces, which was 1,160 calories and 35 grams of saturated fat.
No wonder E.T. is so chubby.
You know, I actually, in my piece, I said, you know, it's a wonder E.T. didn't kill over from a coronary.
You know, I'm going to start a new business. I'm going to put salad bars in movie theaters.
Oh, there you go. Well, apparently the major North American chains Regal, AMC, and Cinemark, those are the largest, the second largest, and third largest, and that's also the way they came in as far as calorie and health-wise, their popcorn offerings. Regal came in as the most unhealthy, AMC the second most healthy, and Cinemark the third most unhealthy. Apparently, they're underreporting the number of calories in their popcorn.
So what they post is not accurate?
What they post is not accurate, if they post anything. Is this a big deal?
No.
Not even remotely.
Yeah, I mean, as I pointed out in the piece, they don't claim to be selling anything other than candy. So what were you expecting? You know,
anyone who doesn't know it's fattening is out of their mind. But you know what? It's also fattening prices. I go to movies so much I rarely get popcorn and soda, but I'll do it for like a particular pop. I'll do it for Avatar, but I actually did it for Twilight Saga New Moon. I got a small popcorn, a small soda. They tried to upsize me. Don't you want a medium? It's 30 cents less, 40 cents. No, I don't. I don't want a medium.
A just medium is small. Less.
The medium is the size of a tankard. You know, it's the size of a small, you know, ship. And I'm like, no, I want the small $8.39 for the smallest popcorn they had and the smallest soda. It was more than my ticket.
Oh, yeah. So that's how they make their money.
It's a big deal on the prices and a big whoop that it's fattening.
Well, our third story is about one of my favorite subjects, Hulu, which now gets access to music videos from EMI, which amps up the competition between YouTube, which also shows music videos, and Hulu. Is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Big whoop.
Yeah, I could care less.
It's a big whoop, but the more stuff spreads out to the world, the better. People should be showing it online.
And I don't really watch music videos to begin with, and I'm glad the music video is making a comeback. Hulu is launching the service with exclusive footage of Nora Jones performing music from her new album, The Fall, in concert at Les Poissons Rouges in New York City.
Oh my God, does anybody care?
It's a cool club. It's a cool club.
Well, moving on to other musicians, Michael Jackson's glove sells for $350,000 at auction. A black jacket he wore during a 1989 world tour fetched $225,000. And this was an auction held at Julian's Auctions. And the owner, Darren Julian, called it the holy grail of Michael Jackson, this glove. And many expected it to sell for more than its pre-sale estimate of about $50,000. The buyer was a Hong Kong businessman, Bossman Ma, who paid $420,000 when you tack on commission.
Doesn't he have like 10 sparkly gloves?
Well, this was the glove that was first worn by Jackson when he staged the famous moonwalk dance at the 1980. Well, apparently
it's authenticated by the auctioneers. Yeah. They wouldn't claim that unless it's true.
Yeah.
It would be authenticated by the family and the people, and that's the only one, etc.
Precisely. And the opening bid was $10,000, so already well out of my price range of $1.50, and leaped immediately to $120,000 before peaking at $350,000. Big deal or big whoop, Karen?
I think interesting. I'm not sure it's really one or the other.
I'll say it's a big whoop. It's never smart to buy stuff at auction like this right at the heat of the moment. You know, you'll see everything for The Lord of the Rings was really expensive right up to and then during the movie releases. And now it's gone back down a little bit. So let's see where the glove is at 20, 30 years from now as far as the value of Michael Jackson memorabilia. If I was going to buy a Michael Jackson glove, that would be the one. Big whoop.
Yeah, probably big whoop.
Screenwriter Jessica Bendinger is launching her own screenwriting contest to help promote her book, The Seven Rays, which is going to be published by Simon & Schuster on November 24th. She's inviting aspiring screenwriters to adapt any portion of the book into a 2-to-5-page screenplay. There is only one catch, which is the contest is promoted by Final Draft, so the writers have to use that software. It's a very well-known screenwriting software for those who...
Which, if you're a screenwriter, if you don't have Final Draft, you shouldn't be a screenwriter, so that seems pretty fair.
Right, and some of the prizes are you get a one-on-one script consultation with Jessica Bendinger, who wrote Bring It On. Some other prizes are you get to pitch, you're the five second place winners can pitch an original piece to a producer, agent, development exec, and Bendinger via iChat or Skype. And then third place runners up will win a copy of Final Draft, which kind of makes having it to submit your yeah. entry in the first place kind of moot.
Completely pointless.
Yeah. Is this a big deal or a big whoop? I think it's a big deal that somebody is kind of taking an alternative approach to promoting a product like this.
I think it's an interesting choice, kind of social media-esque, but ultimately big whoop.
It's a super big whoop. It's stupid. It's just you're going to adapt a couple pages from her book, so you're spending your time doing something that can only go forward if she likes it and wants it to. It's just, you know, it's just
nice
silly.
Try.
Well, our next story, I'm sure ABC hopes is a big deal, Lost. The season premiere will be on February 2nd, 2010. They finally set a date for it, and they're moving the show from Thursday to Tuesday evenings at 9 p.m. Is this a big deal? Does anybody still care about Lost? Does anybody still remember what was going on that show? Is this a big deal or a big whoop?
I think this is a big whoop because who cares? A TV show is coming back, but do I care? Hell yeah, I still care.
Michael?
I say big whoop. The show was for a season or two was the biggest show on TV, and there'll be some attention and hoopla, but it's way past its day. I gave up 2 years ago.
I think when the final episode of Lost airs, there will be a collective gathering at television sets throughout North America, like there was for MASH.
Oh, my God, no. Are you kidding me?
Yes, absolutely, yes.
Absolutely.
Absolutely not. Compared to, it will not be one of the biggest TV finales of all time. You're saying on the level of MASH?
Well, I think it will be
Seinfeld?
I'm not.
Lost.
Yes.
More like the end of Felicity level.
No, absolutely not.
Please. It's not even remotely in the league of MASH and Seinfeld. Those are the two biggest hits of all time, practically.
So is Lost. Lost changed the way we watch television.
Not even close. Lost changed
the way that we watch television.
People will gather. It will be one of the big finales of this season, but it will not be a historic finale.
Okay.
Yes, it will.
Well, moving on. Adam Lambert at the American Music Awards last night, which not only did we not include in this podcast, because probably none of us watched it, but did you see his performance?
Yeah.
And
yep.
His whole, like, simulating fellatio and... Adam Lambert made his first big post-Idol splash tonight, closing the American Music Awards with a performance of his debut single, For Your Entertainment. This was on Entertainment Weekly. Adam dragging a female backup dancer across the stage by her leg as if she were a lace-covered sack of potatoes is what you got to see, as well as Adam grasping the head of a submissive-styled male backup dancer and pulling him into an uncomfortable round of simulated oral sex. While ABC muted the audio to protect us from... Who only knows what?
I know, right?
Uncomfortable for who?
What are they protecting us from?
A tutu-clad woman cupping Adam's nether regions, Adam grasping and snapping the leather bikini area, for lack of a better term, of a female dancer's costume, and Adam taking a break from his singing duties for an impromptu game of tongue twister with a keyboardist of indeterminate gender.
Impromptu my ass.
I thought this was so over-rehearsed and under-rehearsed. It clearly had been rehearsed, and he hadn't gotten into it yet, is what it felt like to me. I was bored. I thought it was way over the top. I thought it was ridiculous. I saw footage of the actual rehearsal on YouTube. It was so much more interesting.
It was embarrassing. It was like a desperate attempt to be Madonna and to be controversial and exciting. And it was like a high school production of Cabaret. It's a big whoop because it was a lame attempt to be controversial, but a big deal because it was a big opportunity to launch his single. You know, he had the single on the movie 2012, but now this. And I thought it was, who remembers the song? It was just lame.
Except that we're talking about it on a podcast, so it definitely...
We're talking about how lame it is.
But we're talking about it, period.
Well, Entertainment Weekly thought it felt like a carefully planned stab at dominating the post-AMA blogosphere water cooler discussion. So,
and we're talking about it.
And we are talking about it.
It worked.
No, it didn't work. It was bad. It was embarrassing. Not because it was controversial, because it wasn't. Because people just went, oh, please. That's not successful.
So, Karen, you're saying that this Adam Lambert thing is a big deal or a big whoop?
It's sort of a big deal, I suppose. Not a huge deal, but it's worth talking about.
Michael?
I think it's a big deal that he failed to launch his album in a good way, but it's a big whoop as far as trying to be controversial.
Well, talking about controversy, we move on to Inside Baseball. Rich Ross, the new head of Walt Disney Studios, the new chairman. Dick Cook was summarily thrown out by Bob Iger, the CEO, and Rich Ross, the former head of the Disney Channel, was put in. He's been making a lot of news this week. First off, he put Captain Nemo, 2,000 Leagues Under the Sea, the remake of 2,000 Leagues Under the Sea, into turnaround. It was a $150 million film that was going to be directed by Mick G. The production had already begun in Rosarito, Mexico. They already spent $10 million building sets and on pre-production. And it looks like it's not going to go anytime soon. He put it into turnaround.
And you want to describe what turnaround is for people who don't know?
Oh, turnaround is when they basically take an intellectual property and shelve it.
Give another studio the opportunity to buy it. So yeah, they're essentially shelving it, but it's not, it's still out there for somebody to buy. It's not like they're putting it on their own shelf.
Yeah, so, I don't know. I don't think they're going to like let that go too quickly.
Seems to me like it's probably a good idea to have let it go. It seems like it was overpriced and not worth it. And frankly, you kind of lost me at McGee.
Yeah, well, but you know, it's Michael Chabon, the Pulitzer Prize winning novelist, was working on the screenplay, and he's already written a draft of their big franchise, John Carter of Mars, which stars Taylor Kitsch or Tim Riggins of Friday Night Lights. And, you know, I don't know. These were the geniuses who were freaked out by Pirates of the Caribbean and how fey Johnny Depp was. Now they're making this movie. Oh, it's too dark. You know what? If it's a rough and tumble modern 20,000 Leagues and it needs to be dark and that's the best movie to make, then make it. So what if it's PG-13 or R? That's okay. You know, if they don't like it, they don't like it. But to say it's too dark, you know what? You can't make every franchise family friendly. I doubt that Michael Chabon was going for an X rating. So,
well, that is not the only change that Rich Ross has made at Walt Disney Studios over the past couple of weeks. According to the Los Angeles Times, in an article that was mentioned by Ben Fritz earlier, the novice movie chairman and his boss, Walt Disney Company chief executive Bob Iger, want to create a new business model for Hollywood to address the sweeping changes that are roiling the entertainment industry, including slumping DVD sales and the growing role the internet plays in movie marketing. They are seeking to recast the studio for the digital era, apparently. If it works, it could be emulated by other studios, but right now, the question is, how many people are they ticking off at theaters and at Best Buy and at, you know, cable companies?
This is back to shortening the window between theatrical release and DVD, right?
Well, I mean, that's kind of what's implied by this story, yes.
And at the end, there's a brilliant description where they say, Iger's overarching strategy is to amass a stable of recognizable entertainment brands like Pixar and Marvel and exploit the films across its TV, theme parks, consumer products, and game divisions. That's what's known as the Disney strategy for the past, oh, I don't know, 75 years?
Well, Ross has been busy meeting with executives all over town and some bigwig producers such as Joe Roth and big-time filmmakers like Tim Burton, who those two produced and directed Alice in Wonderland, which will be released next March. He's met with Jerry Bruckheimer. Tim Burton is supposedly now a fan. ultimately, this is just a story about a guy who's coming in and stirring the pot and changing the way the rules in Hollywood work and turning everything on its head. And the question is, if will it work? And if it does, will other studios follow? And if it doesn't, will it ruin Disney?
But there are no details. He's not changing anything. He's just canceling a project he doesn't like and taking charge. Other than that, there's no specific changes that he's made. There's no new business model that they've revealed.
Well, it was an interesting piece and well worth reading. Whether there's new information in it or not, I think there is some prognostication there that time will bear out. Now, before we sign off today, we have been threatening to read a listener's email, and we actually have one from Patrick in India. He writes, "I am writing to inquire why The Hollywood Reporter has literally wiped India off the face of the earth in the Hollywood Reporter International AFM special issue. On page S41, you will see an ocean between Pakistan, Nepal, and Sri Lanka, where formerly 1.2 billion people lived. Meanwhile, the write-up of India, though the country does not get a header, points towards Myanmar, or Burma. The flag included is the flag of Iran. The object chosen to represent the country is a Middle Eastern oil lamp, Aladdin lamp, which has no Indian relevance. I find it somewhat worrying that the world's most prolific film-producing nation should not exist in THR's world perspective. Apparently, we were CC'd on this letter, and it was sent to Elizabeth Guider over at The Hollywood Reporter."
Oh my gosh.
Yes.
So we could hold it up to the light and make sure the world heard about it. Well, the people of The Hollywood Reporter need to take geography lessons, and B, the Bollywood is a huge industry.
Yes, it is. Well, if you want to contact us either via email or voicemail, you can have your email read too if you send it to dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. Or maybe we'll play your voicemail. All you have to do is call 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. Links to any of the stories we talked about on today's show can be found in our show notes on our website. The address to look up is showbizsandbox.com. That's also where you'll find links to all of our social networking accounts, including LinkedIn and Twitter. Our Twitter handle is @showbizsandbox. Pretty simple. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT, and they can be found on MySpace at myspace.com/MGMT or on their own website, whoismgmt.com. Now, Michael, you can be found at michaelgiltz.com and on Twitter at michaelgiltz. Karen is on Twitter as well, kwoody3939. And can be found online at industrynexus.com. We should thank Ben Fritz of the Los Angeles Times for joining us. He's on Twitter at Ben Fritz is the name to look up. I'm on Twitter at Sperling is the name to look up. Until next week, play nice.